Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka again with another episode, continuing with Sri Aurobindo's Essays on the Gita, Chapter 5, Kurukshetra, page 42. To reiterate, just for a moment before continuing, let me repeat that he says it's self-evident that in the actual life of man, intellectual, social, political, moral, we can make no real step forward without a struggle, a battle between what exists and lives, and what seeks to exist and live, and between all that stands behind either. It's impossible, at least as men and things are, to advance, to grow, to fulfill, and still to observe really and utterly that principle of harmlessness, which is yet placed before us as the highest and best law of conduct. We will use only soul force, and never destroy by force, or any even defensive employment of physical violence, yes? Good, though until soul force is effective, the asuric force in men and nations tramples down, breaks, slaughters, burns, pollutes, as we see it doing today. But then, at its ease and unhindered, and you have perhaps caused as much destruction of life by your abstinence as others by resort to violence. Still, you have set up an ideal which may someday, and at any rate ought to, lead to better things. But even soul force, when it is effective, destroys. Only those who have used it with eyes open know just how much more terrible and destructive it is than the sword and the cannon. And only those who do not limit their view to the act and its immediate results can see how tremendous are its after effects, how much is eventually destroyed, and with that, much, all the life that depended on it and fed upon it. Evil cannot perish without the destruction of much that lives by the evil. And it is no less destruction even if we personally are saved the pain of a sensational act of violence. Moreover, every time we use soul force, we raise a great force of karma against our adversary, the after movements of which we have no power to control. Vashistha uses soul force against the military violence of Vishwamitra, and the armies of Huns and Shakas and Pallavas hurl themselves on the aggressor. The very quiescence and passivity of the spiritual man under violence and aggression awakens the tremendous forces of the world to a retributive action. And it may even be more merciful to stay in their path, though by force, those who represent evil than to allow them to trample on until they call down on themselves a worse destruction than we would ever think of inflicting. It's not enough that our own hands should remain clean and our souls unstained for the law of strife and destruction to die out of the world. That which is its root must first disappear out of humanity. Much less will mere immobility and inertia, unwilling to use or incapable of using any kind of resistance to evil, abrogate the law. Inertia, tamas, indeed, injures much more than can the rajasic principle of strife, which at least creates more than it destroys. Therefore, so far as the problem of the individual's action goes, his abstention from strife and its inevitable concomitant destruction in their more gross and physical form may help his own moral being, but it leaves the slayer of creatures unabolished. For the rest, the whole of human history bears witness to the inexorable vitality and persistent prevalence of this principle in the world. It's natural that we should attempt to palliate, to lay stress on other aspects. Strife and destruction are not all. There is the saving principle of association and mutual help, as well as the force of dissociation and mutual strife. A power of love, no less than a power of egoistic self-assertion, an impulse to sacrifice ourselves for others as well as the impulse to sacrifice others to ourselves. But when we see how these have actually worked, we shall not be tempted to gloss over or ignore the power of their opposites. Association has been worked not only for mutual help, but at the same time for defense and aggression, to strengthen us against all that attacks or resists in the struggle for life. Association itself has been a servant of war, egoism, and the self-assertion of life against life. Now, love itself has been constantly a power of death, especially the love of good and the love of God, as embraced by the human ego, have been responsible for much strife, slaughter, and destruction. Self-sacrifice is great and noble, but at its highest is an acknowledgement of the law of life by death, and becomes an offering on the altar of some power that demands a victim in order that the work desired may be done. The mother bird, facing the animal of prey in defense of its young. The patriot, dying for his country's freedom. The religious martyr on the martyr of an idea. These, in the lower and superior scale of animal life, are highest examples of self-sacrifice, and it's evident to what they bear witness. But if we look at after results, an easy optimism becomes even less possible. See the patriot dying in order that his country may be free, and mark that country a few decades after the Lord of Karma has paid the price of the blood and the suffering that was given. You shall see it in its turn, an oppressor, an exploiter, and conqueror of colonies and dependencies, devouring others that it may live and succeed aggressively in life. The Christian martyrs perished in their thousands, setting soul force against empire force that Christ may conquer, Christianity prevail. Well, soul force does triumph, Christianity does prevail, but not Christ. The victorious religion becomes a militant and dominant church and a more fanatically persecuting power than the creed and the empire which it replaced. The very religions organize themselves into powers of mutual strife and battle together fiercely to live, to grow, possess the world. All which seems to show that here is an element in existence, perhaps the initial element, which we do not know how to conquer, either because it cannot be conquered, or because we have not looked at it with a strong and impartial gaze so as to recognize it calmly and fairly and know what it is. We must look existence in the face if our aim is to arrive at a right solution, whatever that solution may be. And to look existence in the face is to look God in the face, for the two cannot be separated, nor the responsibility for the laws of world existence be shifted away from Him who created them or from that which constituted it. Yet, here too, we love to palliate and equivocate. We erect a God of love and mercy, a God of good, a just God, righteous and virtuous, according to our own moral conceptions of justice, virtue, and righteousness. And all the rest, we say, is not God. It is not His, but was made by some diabolical power which He suffered, for some reason, to work out its wicked will, or by some dark Ahriman counterbalancing our gracious Ormuzd. Or it was even the fault of selfish and sinful man who has spoiled what was made originally perfect by God. As if man had created the law of death and devouring in the animal world, or that tremendous process by which nature creates indeed and preserves, but in the same step and by the same inextricable action slays and destroys. It's only a few religions which have had the courage to say, without any reserve, like the Indian, that this enigmatic world power is one deity, one trinity, to lift up the image of the force that acts in the world in the figure not only of the beneficent Durga, but of the terrible Kali in her blood-stained dance of destruction, and to say, this too is the mother. This also know to be God. This too, if thou hast the strength, adore. And it is significant that the religion which has had this unflinching honesty and tremendous courage has succeeded in creating a profound and widespread spirituality such as no other can parallel. For truth is the foundation of real spirituality, and courage is its soul. Tasyai Satyam Ayatanam. All this is not to say that strife and destruction are the alpha and omega of existence, that harmony is not greater than war, love more the manifest divine than death, or that we must not move towards the replacement of physical force by soul force, of war by peace, of strife by union, of devouring by love, of egoism by universality, and of death by immortal life. God is not only the destroyer, but the friend of creatures. Not only the cosmic trinity, but the transcendent. The terrible Kali is also the loving and beneficent mother. The Lord of Kurukshetra is the divine comrade and charioteer, the attractor of beings, the incarnate Krishna. And whithersoever he is driving through all the strife and clash and confusion, to whatever goal or godhead he may be attracting us, it is, no doubt of that, to some transcendence of all these aspects upon which we have been so firmly insisting. But where, how, with what kind of transcendence, under what conditions, this we have to discover. And to discover it, the first necessity is to see the world as it is, to observe and value rightly his action as it reveals itself at the start and now. Afterwards, the way and the goal will better reveal themselves. We must acknowledge Kurukshetra. We must submit to the law of life by death before we can find our way to the life immortal. We must open our eyes, with a less appalled gaze than Arjuna's, to the vision of our Lord of time and death, and cease to deny, or hate, or recoil from the universal destroyer. Okay, so thus ends Chapter 5, Kurukshetra, from Essays on the Gita. Thank you for tuning in, and hope to find you listening next time.
This is Orville Radio.